Turning now to the book of Daniel, chapter 5 and verse 1. The book of Daniel, chapter 5, verse 1. Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. And our title is Let When Babylon Fell. And we come to this point in the book of Daniel. And Belshazzar is abruptly introduced to us as king. King of Babylon. We would say emperor, effectively, of the mighty Babylon. And you probably know that the existence of Daniel was denied, and the existence, not the existence of Daniel, but the existence of Belshazzar was denied by many, many critics of the Bible, right up really until the late 1920s and 1930s, when became known that there were inscriptions naming him in the ancient monuments and tablets, and so he could no longer be denied. But then the criticism tended to switch. Yes, well, he existed, but he was never king. And increasingly, the evidence came to light that he was indeed king, was son of Nabonidus, the king, who was frequently out of town, it would seem, and one in whom was vested all the power of control and rule in his father's absence. So Belshazzar did reign and was effectively regent or king, and nobody really can deny that now. Belshazzar the king, this is some 70 years after the first chapter in Babylon. It's right before, as you know, the fall of Babylon, when this takes place. Well, Nebuchadnezzar has died. Several of his sons have succeeded him in turn, with extremely short reigns, 2 years, 1 year, 2 months in one case. And then Nabonidus takes the throne and the power. He wasn't a son of Nebuchadnezzar, but he did become a son-in-law, possibly after Nebuchadnezzar's death. He was made king, made emperor, and he seems perhaps, probably, to have married one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters, and Belshazzar was his son. So Belshazzar actually did have a blood link to Nebuchadnezzar, which his father, Nabonidus, the largely absentee king, did not have. But here it is, the first verse. Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords. An extraordinary thing to do in the circumstances, because the forces of Cyrus the Mede were at the door, and Babylon would fall. Of course, they didn't think so. They were very confident. They felt very safe. But nevertheless, a strange thing to throw a great celebration, a tremendous feast, and bring in provincial rulers and so on to join the celebration. A brazen act of confidence right under the nose of the enemy. This is the pride of these emperors or these kings of the Chaldeans. Belshazzar the king made a great feast, a vast, huge hall which has been unearthed, which could very well be the site of this, and 1,000, well, a vast number of his subordinates and his various courtiers and rulers, and drank wine before the 1,000. And verse 2, Belshazzar, whilst he tasted the wine, which some translate, you know, as to read to this effect, while the wine took its influence and its course upon him, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem. This is really an extreme act. Now, you know that through the book of Daniel, God has moved in a remarkable way to preserve the safety and security of the Jews who had been taken out of Jerusalem and Judah and were living in various parts of the Babylonian Empire, and how would they be treated? Well, with various moves to exterminate them, even genocide we've seen, and to denounce them and to get rid of them or hurt them, the Lord through this book preserves them on behalf of the faithful remnant in a very remarkable way, time after time. But you see the increasing pride of first Nebuchadnezzar, and now you see it in in Belshazzar, his descendant, with this great feast. But he does what Nebuchadnezzar never did. He took these precious vessels that had belonged to the temple in Jerusalem and proceeded to pour scorn on them and to insult them, and the God of Israel, by drinking the wine out of them with which they would praise their idol gods. And that's the sense of verse 2. So public contempt. This is going to be a reversal. Each time God has intervened in the history of the Chaldeans, as we see it in the book of Daniel, there's been a distinct preservation coming out of things. But now all this is going to be reversed, it would appear, by Belshazzar. Nebuchadnezzar said, nobody must speak a word against the faith of the Jews. But now they're going to be publicly scorned. It's his way of reversing all that. This isn't just a personal act of blasphemy, as it were, antagonism against the God of Israel, the one true God, but it indicates a whole era that could develop. Of course it won't, because Babylon is now coming to an end. But you read of how this was duly enacted. Verse 4, they drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. And that public contempt was enacted and carried through. And it's a reversal then of, say, you might like to turn to chapter 3 and verse 29 and read the formal declaration that Nebuchadnezzar had made in the past, years earlier. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and so on. And there's something rather similar, though not so explicit, in chapter 4 and verse 37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honour the King of Heaven. Of course, he wasn't converted to him. He carried on being a polytheist and worshipping his Babylonian gods. But he officially appointed, once again, the God of Israel to be respected and regarded and recognized and accepted throughout the empire. That's the effect of all that. But that's what's going on. Under Belshazzar, they're worshipping the gods of fertility and of war and of crafts of different kinds and industry and so on. So what has happened is that the ignorance shown by Nebuchadnezzar about the one true God and the Jews in chapter 2, well, it grew, and you see it became supreme indifference and self-confidence by chapter 3, and by chapter 4 it was staggering pride, but now in chapter 5, in Belshazzar, it's insolence against God and renewed antagonism. And that's what you're seeing in these opening verses, and it shouldn't be underestimated. But then verse 5, in the same hour, once it reached insolence and scorn and derision, and we see that today. There's always been atheism and unbelief. There's always been opposition to the Bible and to the gospel and to the truth. But we've never seen so much open public scorn, even by high and well-placed people. I'm not just thinking of the websites associated with somebody like Professor Richard Dawkins. You look at those websites and the comments and you see the hatred and the scorn. But it's everywhere now, the public open scorn. Interesting that God acted most severely, not when it was ignorance, nor even when it was indifference, nor even when it was pride and self-confidence, or when it became insolence, then God acted. And I read much into that for our times, another indication that these are the end times. We've reached the time of undisguised scorn and derision. Verse 5, in the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand. That makes you think, why just the fingers of a man's hand? Why not the figure of a man? Well, as the old writers used to point out, that would be too interesting. The mind would be well drawn to the figure. Who's that? Who does it represent? But the figure is of no consequence, so it's not there. Fingers, yes, to compel the attention of the king. And words. What's important are the words. God is going to speak through words. A figure of a person is not relevant. There's no sword. There's no symbolism there. There's no bow or arrow. Just the fingers to compel attention and the words. Actually, that would make a good study for today. In these days of gimmickry, when people want to use, even earnest Christians sometimes, want to use all sorts of other things beside the word, as though the word's not good enough. The word can't attract attention. The word can't compel. The word needs, you need drama or human intervention or various other things in your evangelism and so on. And there's a lesson here. Just the fingers, compelling attention, and then the word. That's all that's important. And wrote over against the candlestick or the lampstand upon the plaster of the wall. Obviously, near to where the king was, somewhere where maybe the brightest part of the room, where he would see. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote, and it terrified him. That was what it was designed to do. Verse 6, then the king's countenance was changed. He couldn't hold his composure. He couldn't control himself. His countenance was changed. He probably bleached out in colour. The tension on his face and the terror was evident. His body shook and it was visible to all and he couldn't stop it. He was in a tremendous state. Emperors, kings, used to controlling their deportment and their stance. But he was terrified. As the verses go on, you can see indications that he gets over it and controls himself. But initially, this terrified him. Well, it's not surprising, in a way, because this could indicate something awful. After all, the Medes and the Persians, their forces, the generals, were very near. They were virtually halfway round Babylon already. Now, there was confidence in Babylon. It said that they had provisions stored in Babylon for 3 or 4 years to withstand any siege. Couldn't be done. The walls were considered impregnable. The one weak point, which wasn't a weak point really, until, well, I'll tell you this later, what happened, but the one weak point was where the Euphrates River ran through that vast city, the point at which it entered under the walls and left at the other side. And that was really the only feasible way in, and that was hardly a way in. So they felt confident, and they boosted themselves. But still, there was tension, and so something like this could be a terrible indication of disaster. And he was terrified. The king cried aloud to bring in, and there's the customary list that we've seen before in the book of Daniel, the astrologers, Chaldeans, soothsayers, they were all Chaldeans, of course, in control there, the forces, everybody. But here the Chaldeans is used as a term for a particular school of wise men and philosophers. And in they came, and the king made this extravagant promise. He couldn't read the writing. This is a point of debate. What was the writing? What language was it in? Some say it was ancient Phoenician. So I guess, of course, I don't know how they would arrive at that conclusion. Others say it was a form of old Babylonian that only a very considerable scholar would still be familiar with. Others say, no, it was Chaldean, but which it is, of course, but it was ordinary Chaldean that was written, but God just blinded them in some way, so worked that they couldn't read it, they couldn't make it out, until Daniel explained it. So we really don't know whether it was by God's act that they were unable to read it, or it was in a script that wasn't readable. But the words, of course, are perfectly familiar ones. But the king said to the wise men the reward that they'd get if they could read this writing. And verse 8, they come in, but they could not read the writing, nor make known to the king the interpretation thereof. It wasn't just a matter of the interpretation, they couldn't make it out. When Daniel reads the words to them, they're probably astonished, but they couldn't tell what they represented. Then was the king Belshazzar greatly troubled. He's getting worse for the moment, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished, or stunned, or horrified. The very people who'd come in to this piece of absurd last-minute triumphalism. Remember many years ago, there was a big financial man in the city who had got overreached, ran his own bank, going back a good number of years, and the evening came when he was going to be arrested. And they'd found, the fraud squad, whoever operated in those days, they'd found that to try and cover his debts and get on and pay his staff and everything, half his transactions had been crooked. But the very afternoon, this just sticks in my mind, I remember this, reading reports of this years ago, the very afternoon before the evening of his arrest, he bought 5 of the most expensive racehorses. What's that got to do with it? Well, the things people will do on the verge of their collapse, the confidence they can have, and the security they can feel. We see this in life a lot. When things are about to fall to pieces, people often, they don't see it coming. So the colonial powers, including we ourselves in Britain here, sometimes it's been obvious that in a certain region of the world, the conduct of the colonial power has been horrifically overbearing. And the reaction has been building up. And you'd have to be blind not to see it. This is going to explode one day. There's going to be a tremendous reaction against this, and the colonial power is going to lose out. Or there's going to be fighting and war and resistance. And yet the oppressors, I'm not suggesting all colonialism has been oppressive, but the oppressors, where it's so, don't see it. Right to the last moment, they're still behaving in a way that is going to provoke a terrible reaction. That's human nature. It's amazing. It's the same with so many people, even who've heard the gospel and been affected by it sometimes, would have resisted it or rejected it. Now they're old, and they're nearing their last breath, and it's obvious to everyone. Now they're sick. Perhaps this is their terminal, their last illness. And they're still not concerned about eternity. So we're not terribly surprised to see a mighty empire on its last legs, with a powerful enemy at the door, still behaving as though there's nothing to be concerned about, nothing to worry about. That's typical of human nature in so many ways. But then you read about the queen. Which queen is this? Very likely not the wife of Belshazzar, but possibly the widow of Nebuchadnezzar. Now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting house. But just a minute, we've read previously that his wives and his concubines were already in the banqueting house. So this isn't his wife. The queen, yes, must be Nebuchadnezzar's widow. And she's going to introduce Daniel to them. He's been out of the picture for some years, perhaps, ever since the death, maybe, of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had an evil eldest son who was the first two-year reign following him. He wouldn't have wanted any truck with Daniel. So Daniel's been out of power, as it were, and influence, out of the reckoning for some time. So maybe this is Nebuchadnezzar's widow. By reason of the words of the king and his lords, this has been muttered outside the banqueting hall, came into the banquet house, and the queen spake and said, O king, live for ever. Let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor let thy countenance be changed. The customary polite approach to the sovereign. Verse 11, there is a man in thy kingdom. She's still a polytheist. She seems to be quite enamored of Daniel, but she's certainly not a Christian. There is a man in thy kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. She speaks like a polytheist. And in the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods. It's not the language of a believer, but nevertheless she's been taken by Daniel. Was found in him, whom the king, Nebuchadnezzar, thy father. Oh, somebody showed me a passage in one of these new atheist writers, one of the famous books that's come out in the last 10 years, criticizing everything imaginable in the Bible. And here was typically one of the criticisms that the book of Daniel calls Nebuchadnezzar Belshazzar's father. How absurd, how ridiculous. But if the learned writer of that unbelieving book had only looked it up and done his research, he would have found that in Hebrew and in Chaldean, there is no word for grandfather. So you have to say father for a grandfather. It's not a mistake. If Nebuchadnezzar was his grandfather, he'd still be called in the Bible his father. That's typical of the book of Daniel and the whole of the Old Testament. Anyway, that's aside. Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, the king, I say thy father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. A post which Daniel, no doubt, had never taken up. He would never have associated with that lot. But never, anyway, he was given the honor, even if the only person who remembers it is Nebuchadnezzar's widow. Verse 12, for as much as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting of dreams. What lengths she has to go to convince Belshazzar that it's worth calling on this man. He is quite out of the mainstream now, Daniel. She gives every possible commendation. Showing of hard sentences, dissolving of doubts, were found in the same Daniel. She uses his name. She even seems to know that he hated being called Belteshazzar, the name assigned to him by Nebuchadnezzar, because that fastened a Chaldean god onto his name. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. Now, what follows is extraordinary. Then was Daniel brought in before the king, and the king spake unto him. Have you ever seen words like this? Belshazzar is getting over his horror, and his astonishment, and his fear and terror. his pride is pouring back into him, and his insolence. And look at the way he addresses Daniel. He depends upon him, because no one else can explain the writing. He's got to turn to him, but from what he says, he's the last person he ever would have turned to. He's got to show some courtesy to the Queen Mum, who's commended him so strongly, Daniel, but with what reluctance he does it. Listen to these haughty words. I don't know whether you read it this way, but the Bible couldn't work harder to get across the haughtiness and supercilious attitude of Belshazzar. Art thou that Daniel which art of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought out of Jewry? Even when he's in desperate need and he's been terrified out of his life, confronted against his taste by Daniel, he talks down to him and insults him, and he uses this withering language. Are you that Daniel brought out of the dredges of that city of Jerusalem, which we disposed of and conquered so easily, by the goodwill of my grandfather, brought out here? Are you one of them Jewish people? That's how it rings, the language of Belshazzar. Verse 14, I have even heard of thee. He's going to keep him at arm's length. I've heard of you. He should have consulted him. He should have honored him. They should have had honorable memories of Daniel and the contribution he'd made, even to his enemies. I have even heard of thee. The stench of reluctance about these words. That the spirit of the gods is in thee. He's sticking to polytheistic language. And that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. He just about can get the words out as he asks his favor. He doesn't want to do this. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof, but they could not show the interpretation of the thing. I have heard of thee. Yes, he had heard of him. But he paid no attention to him, never listened to him, never sent for him, never respected him. That thou canst make interpretations and dissolve doubts. Now if thou canst read the writing and make known to me the interpretation, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about thy neck and shalt be the third ruler in the kingdom. He's got to make the same reward that he's offered to the others. Daniel's answer is extraordinary. It is so courageous. This despot, this tyrant of a man, this enemy of his people, of the Jewish people, that is. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let thy gifts be to thyself and give thy rewards to another. He makes it clear he's not like the wise men and the astrologers. They did it all for pay. They did it all for advantage and promotion. And lands and estates and special treatment. He doesn't speak for those things at all. So he starts by declining the rewards. Yet I will read the writing unto the king and make known to him the interpretation. And then a tremendous sermon which everybody hears, the 1,000 lords, everybody in the banqueting chamber, it's public, it's out. And it's a tremendous, well, it's a diatribe against the king. How can Daniel do it? What courage this is. O thou king, that's the address. Now the message starts. The Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And he was respected by all nations and people trembled before him. And he had absolute power to do, dispose of people or promote people as he thought fit. Verse 20, but when his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, those two lines are worthy of study, really. Not only was his heart lifted up in self-confidence and self-esteem, but his mind was hardened in pride. That's an important statement, just on the side, hardened in pride. Pride is hardening. Pride has that powerful setting cement in it. It gets into us, and we think well of ourselves, and we begin to think we're so important, but it's not something you can dismiss in a moment or recover from overnight. It sets hard, hardened in pride. Even if you repent of it, it doesn't want to go. It takes strong treatment and imploring of God and anxiety and concern to get rid of pride once it's in. But when he came to this, he was deposed, that sort of extraordinary, real, but symbolic deposing from his power, that spell of madness, and they took his glory from him. You knew about that. The humbling of the greatest Chaldean emperor ever. And yet you never learned from it, says Daniel to him. End of verse 21, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointeth over it whomsoever he will, and thou, his son, or grandson, so to speak, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this, but rather hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, mounted this great attack in the last moment of the empire, when he should have been concerned about its safety and defense. He mounted this great campaign against the Jews. And they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou, thy lord's wives, concubines, have drunk in them. And thou hast not, and thou hast praised the gods of silver and gold, brass, iron, wood, and stone. Well, you've seen the passage, and I go on to the end of verse 23. The one who controls your life and all your ways, thou hast not glorified. And so Daniel says, the part of the hand was from him, and this writing was written. Then he gets down to business. But he's preached his sermon before he gets to those words. He's held the king in suspense. He's said these awful things to him. Well, it's the truth. He's risked the reaction of Belshazzar. This is the writing, you know the words. This is the interpretation. God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting. Thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Amazing. Verse 29. Astonishing. Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. What would you expect the text to say there? Then Belshazzar commanded Daniel to be executed for treasonable words in front of the great crowd assembled of nobles and rulers for celebration, predicting the fall of the city and the empire. Get rid of him. But he doesn't. He says, he puts a chain of gold about his neck, clothes him with scarlet, purple actually, royal purple and makes the proclamation that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. What does it mean? Why doesn't he have him put, doesn't he put this madman out? We should never have called him in. Put him out. Get rid of him. Well, you can only explain it as though the king's poise has returned. He is going to act as though he is unaffected by these terrible things that have been said to him. He's going to act as though this is beneath contempt. He can have his prize, his reward, and send him away. But I'm not going to credit these words with any significance. I'm not going to be intimidated by them. I'm going to maintain my royal posture. I'm not going to show any dismay or concern or anger. This is pathetic. This is just an unwelcome intervention. That's the only way you can explain it. That these treasonable words are not punished. This complete reversal of the whole purpose of the feast and the exercise. But he certainly doesn't repent. He certainly isn't affected by them. He's brazen now. He's recovered his poise. He's determined to believe that there can be no danger, that he can be safe. But the word has been spoken, and the word will be carried out. In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. You may know the history well. Cyrus, the attacker, wasn't actually in the region, but his troops were. And two excellent generals were there. Cyrus had been there, departed, come back again. They'd made heavy weather, trying to get into the city. Couldn't be done, was impregnable, but they were there. And then the engineers hit on the idea of diverting the Euphrates down different channels so that the level of the water would drop. And the points where the water, the river, entered and left the city would be, the water level would be low enough for the Median Persian troops to wade in and take the city. And with all the celebrations going on in the city, the watch was not good, and they succeeded. And that's a matter of history, recorded outside the Bible as well as in the city fell. One problem has bothered some people, and that is that it was almost bloodless, not entirely. The enemy troops got in, the city collapsed, the empire was down. Yes, but all the prophecies, such as Jeremiah and Isaiah, had said that Babylon would fall with great bloodshed and commotion. And those prophecies did not seem to be literally carried out. But they were about 14 years later, because while Babylon fell quietly, because of the benevolent manner of government, or comparatively benevolent manner of government of Cyrus, the city of Babylon and its region was able to pull itself together, reassert itself, declare independence, and take a last stand. And that time it was utterly routed and the prophecies were finally fulfilled. However, that's another story. But this is the account of the fall of Babylon. The sidelined prophet is brought in to announce the end of the reign of the king, the emperor. Incidentally, in the book so far, we've seen a succession of miracles. Those miracles achieved a great deal. They preserved the Jews from genocide, from attack, from dismissal, restored their comforts, all on account of the believing remnant among them. But what the miracles never succeeded in doing, they weren't, and God knew they wouldn't achieve this, they never saved the key people involved. Nebuchadnezzar had three great miracles shown to him. He was never saved. This man has this extraordinary experience. It doesn't save him. Miracles don't save. I just think back to the 80s when the late John Wimber, many of you will not remember him, became extraordinarily popular in Britain and in America. American man and a charismatic man, and he brought in his own style of healing and so on and prophecy. And his great point was, and his books were immensely popular and influenced many people and gave rise really to the whole movement of so-called vineyard churches. But he would assert that when Christ was on earth and the apostles, they never saved souls without there being a power encounter. And every time anybody preached or witnessed, there must be a power encounter. Of course, this is ridiculous nonsense, because you can go through the New Testament for yourself and look at all the occasions when Christ taught, and it is by no means true to say that there was always what Wimber would have called a power encounter. There was most certainly not always a miracle. But right from the Old Testament, miracles never saved. That was not what they were intended to do. And through the book of Daniel, these great supernatural interventions and miraculous events, they didn't save. They did what God intended them to do, which was wonderful, to denote his sovereignty and preserve the lives and the peace of his people, but they didn't save. I just thought I'd mention that, because people come up with such foolish things, and then these things become very popular, and whole sections of the charismatic movement are quite carried away with this, the centrality of miracles. In the book of Daniel, and we see from this fifth chapter, before we come on to a shift in theme, we see the importance of the Word and the centrality of the Word of God and the power by the work of the Spirit of the Word of God. These things, dear friends, are for us. Just perhaps one last comment I'd make. Although we're talking about Belshazzar, an unbelieving king, we learn too, as believers, be careful. As Christian people, there's a culture these days and of critical thinking and self-expression and express yourself, what you think, your opinion, your desires, your likes. And people are trained non-stop. Young people, as we were, older generation, never were. Well, my generation, we were put down by our elders. But today, the whole idea is you're special. And what your opinions and your thoughts and your feelings matter. Well, then you're delivered. You're saved. You're given a new perspective, a new life. Christ comes to your life. The Holy Spirit dwells within. And that way of thinking, that mental mechanism, that whole outlook that the world has drilled into you, you've got to get rid of. It's anti-God. It's anti-Christ. And it isn't easy, I think. So I say particularly to the young, be very careful when you're converted to Christ. And you find yourself thinking, yes, but I think this, or I'd like that, or my opinion is this. I feel this is right. I don't agree with that. I think it should be like, watch myself. This is what Satan has programmed for me through my worldly past. Now it's, what does the Lord say? What are the scriptural standards? What's right? What's in the Word? What should it be? It's quite different now. Do watch that, dear friends, because the world puts its stamp upon you. And part of sanctification is to get rid of that stamp and to be a servant of God and humble before him and obedient to him. It's all here in the book of Daniel. Let's close together this evening singing the hymn 509. Hymn number 509. How firm a foundation.